You're listening to Face Off, Episode 10, recorded March 21st, 2009. You're listening to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we like to talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes at faceoffshow.com or follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/faceoffshow. All right. Well, Mark, guess what?
What?
We actually have a guest with us today.
I noticed.
All right. So I want to let everybody know today on our podcast with us, we have Paul Levette.
Hello.
Hello. I work with Paul. We're coworkers. Paul, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I've been doing web development for about 10 years now. I started with PHP, and I'm just now moving into doing full-time Rails development for the last year and a half or so. Rails has turned out to be really good for making rapid apps for what I work for is the research community, scientific research, neuroscience, and so on. And so being able to bust out an app really quickly that's testable and can do the job that needs to be done is really exciting. And working with these smart people to do this has been really gratifying, and it's been one of the better jobs I've had in a long time. So being able to meet together web development with real application development has been great, and Rails has allowed us to do that really, really well. So
awesome. Yeah.
That's what I've been doing.
So when he's talking about his coworkers, he's talking about me. I'm one of those great people that he gets to work with. So Paul is great. Paul and I talk a lot about web apps and stuff, so I thought I'd bring him on the show because he's really insightful, and he's really good at sort of telling me why I'm wrong in a really elegant way that doesn't make me feel stupid. So So let's get into it. Let's talk about some web apps first, Mark.
All right. The first one we got is smush.it. It's another one of those domain-er names. but anyway, Smush It, what is it?
Well, Smush It is a way to optimize groups of images. So a lot of times, I don't know if you've done this, like in Photoshop or something, when you have an image, you kind of like, when you go to save it, you can change your JPEG compression and stuff. And so you kind of like play with the slider a little bit, and you're like, does that look okay? Mm-hmm. This, I believe it makes sure it compresses it so that you don't, it's really lossless, but you still reduce your file size.
Okay. So is this similar to like Pincrush or JPEG Tran? Because I know I wrote a blog post where Adobe Photoshop, the Save for Web feature, does not completely optimize the image. When you use these programs, you can actually reduce the file size, but without any loss.
Yeah, so reduces the header size and pulls out a bunch of the unnecessary stuff.
Right. So does this do similar thing like that? Is it lossless, or is it just compresses it?
I'm not sure if it actually is lossless or not. It doesn't really say outhand, but one of the best parts about it is you can do it in bulk. You can do it with a Firefox extension, or you can just upload the image there on the website, or you can send it a URL with multiple images. And so it'll do it in bulk for you, which, I mean, a lot of us have found that when I use InfraRecorder or EarFan Viewer. I always say it wrong.
What is it? Say it again?
It's EarFan.
Really? I always say EarFan.
Yeah.
EarFan.
Irfan. Is it Irfan?
I don't know, that's how I've been pronouncing it.
That's how I've always said it. But a little
splatted red guy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's the great way to explain. But one of the benefits of using that program is it's lightweight and you can do batch conversions and compressions. And things
I'm reading
like
here,
that.
It actually is non-lossy. So
awesome.
So it's probably doing the same thing as some of those other apps, but on a batch, like you said, on a mass scale or whatever, so you don't have mm-hmm. to manually do it.
Yeah. Mark, you'll really like this. I'm reading their FAQ right now, and one of the things I notice is they, whenever they can, convert to PNG instead of GIFs. Like if you upload a GIF, it converts it to a PNG automatically.
And I didn't know this, but PNG is actually a replacement for GIF. It's not a separate. You know, they've made it for a replacement. So
yeah, and I'm actually really glad, because in recent years it seems like pretty much all the major browsers have supported alpha transparency in PNGs, and that
except IE, the older versions.
Yeah. Well, 6. I mean, you can't.
People still use it, though.
Yeah, I know, it's frustrating.
Like two people,
like 2 million grandmas. But I remember the first time I saw a demo for alpha transparency in PNGs online, and I was like, you scroll the background, and you'd see through it, and I think that widespread support for PNG is just makes me really happy. I think that's a good thing. So, So look at smush.it. You can do it with programs on your computer, or if you want to try a web app to do it, you can. It's kind of a nice little fun program. So
another thing, actually, before we closed the door on that one, is I was noticing in the fact they also have an API. So if you wanted to use a Smush service remotely and just push the images to them and pull it back in the background of your app, it provides that service for you if you want to use it.
You can do it in your app instead.
Right, and it's a nice JSON REST API.
Nice, fine, nice. Yeah, that's really helpful. So if you have anything that you do upload images on, you can throw it to Smush, get it compressed, and suck it back in. So,
or even if you wanted to, you know, have people uploading images, you know, for your service, and you're expecting them to upload profile images, and you just wanted to make sure you don't want to let the user maybe compress it. You want to make sure that it's as tight as possible when you're putting it on your server. Then you can pump it through the Smush it.
Yeah,
that's good.
Definitely very cool.
Great tool.
All right, so the next little website we want to talk about is called openwith.org, and I put this in the notes because I think a lot of people out there, you get this a lot, I get so many questions, especially from my family, being the sort of, you know, family tech guy. It's, you know, someone sent me this dot something something, and what do I use to open it? So openwith.org tells you what to open it with, and tells you a little bit about the file, you know, right away, there's some stuff on here. The recently added ones, they're file types I've never even heard of, and I don't think I ever really want to hear of. But so let's look at DocX, right? The new awesome format from Microsoft, the new thing. You know, it tells you its category. It's a document file format, which is nice to know. And then it also, what's really nice about it is it has links to free programs that open up that file type. So from here, I can see that OpenOffice.org 3.01 can open, edit, create, and print DocX files. And the Microsoft Word Viewer 2007 can open and print DocX files. So not only does it tell you about it, but they try as hard as they can to give you an application that will open it for you.
So yeah. I can see this being really useful for people like people that are not really in the know of which programs to use and find something that's safe, that's not like full of spyware and everything else.
Yeah. I mean, when you get out in the workforce, the worst thing that happens is someone sends you, they just assume that you know how to open a file. And so they send it to you and say, well, here you go. Get some work done with it. And you're sitting there going, I have no idea. And I mean, just the fact that it gives you a free alternative to open it is really nice because sometimes, you know, one of the files on the homepage was like a zebra image file. And I was like, what? I would have no idea how to open that if there wasn't a site like this telling me a free program to open it with. And they seem to have quite a bit of stuff. You can sort by different categories or all kinds of tools and stuff. So,
yeah, the downloadable tool looks kind of interesting. If you're running on Windows, which most people who don't know about file extensions are on Windows, right? There's a little tool that integrates with the Explorer, and you can right-click on any file, and it'll say...
Oh, look at what
desktop tool is there. Now they don't have it for all platforms, but you know, arguably it's not really that useful for the other platforms. For Windows, this is a real place where people don't know what to open things with. Right. So that's good. And I thought it was interesting. I was looking at they seem to have a pretty rich feedback system here. All it is email, but if you think that there's anything wrong with any of the information they're giving out about a particular file type, it states on there they're going to get back to you really quick and they really want to know if there's anything wrong with any of these file types that they have listed here. So they really want to get their users involved in making sure that the information on the website is as good as it can be.
Yeah, that's really important. One thing we talked about a while ago was that, you know, the open source vulnerability database. And what I think makes that so good is that anyone can do it, you know. It's anyone can submit to it, anyone can look at it. It's almost a sort of wiki philosophy of anyone can go ahead and do it. And this does it in sort of a clunky way through email, but it's nice that they do. And that sort of transparency of saying, please help us make it better is always important.
Yeah, this is cool. I really like this app.
I like it too. Actually, I had no idea that there was something out there that performed this.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of sites out there that do this, but I never really like them. I remember when I first found this, I said, this looks like a good, you know, friendly site that I would even send the link to, like, my grandma when she has trouble finding something. I say, well, you want to know about this file? Here's the link. It's not overly tech heavy. It doesn't seem to overload them with a bunch of jargon.
There's a lot of sites, I think, that have the file extension and say what that is, but it doesn't necessarily map a program to it, like an open source program or whatever to it. So I think that's unique a little bit.
Yeah, it's like,
easy to use. It's an easy, simple interface. So
you know, so the Adobe Creative Suite will open it up, but like, well, I don't have $3,000.
And also some of those other app or those websites, at least, they seem fairly shady.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of ads. There's a lot of iffy, like, remove that spyware tool, like, advertisements.
The
and
the
so
nice pop-up that looks like
looks
a Windows.
Really, it reminds you of an open source web page. Mm-hmm. It's simple. It does exactly what it says it's supposed to do, and it doesn't push things at you. It's feels like it's trustworthy.
Yeah, I mean, there's no ads on it at all. It's just open. The only problem, though, is we did try to look at it last night, and they are over their Google Apps quota. Or Google
it means people are using it as popular, though. I'm glad for them. I mean,
yeah, that's good, but not good at the same time. So hopefully they can get that sorted out. Because it is. It's a great, useful site, and I think more people should use it. All right, so the next one that we want to talk about, I'm actually going to throw it over to Paul. It's an app called Sumo Paint. Paul, what is Sumo Paint?
Sumo Paint is a web-based image editor. And I only recently discovered this. I mean, after years and years of fighting with... oh, no, you know, Photoshop is really expensive, and I don't want to pirate it like everybody else does. But I would like to use the GIMP, but the GIMP's interface is also a little bit difficult to come through. And I found that there has been, people have been starting to create web-based image editors, and the best one so far I've seen is Sumo Paint. And Sumo Paint has a really rich Flash-based interface. You can save all the files locally to disk. It has nearly all the features that you'd find on something like Photoshop, at least like 90% of the most used features.
Yeah,
it doesn't have a lot of the really intricate Adobe specialized stuff, but almost everything else, it's great. And it also has a really low barrier to just trying it out. If you go to the website, you click on the big Sumo picture on the left, it immediately opens up and you can try it out. You don't have to sign up for it.
You don't have
to do any kind of... You know, you don't have to give up any personal information to just give it a spin and try it out and see if it's right for what you want to do. And for a lot of the things that I do, which is mostly just, you know, I grabbed an image, I need to resize it, or I need to add a shine to it, I need to buttonize it, all that kind of stuff, it can do. And I've heard some people say that it's too slow, and I haven't verified that myself. I have found it easy to use on all the platforms I've tried it, but... I guess it's possible that on some it's too slow to use, but I personally have not had problems with it at all.
Yeah, what I like about it is you don't have to download anything. You know, if you're at a friend's house that doesn't have any image editing at all, and you need to do something real quick, you know, you could log into the site and fix up an image.
You're not running and grabbing some other image editor, installing it on his machine.
Right.
Exactly.
And, you know, because that's a little bit
like even like the open source one, the GIMP is clunky to install. We're lucky that it comes on, you know, any major platform, but I installed it on OS X the other day, and it was like, well, you have to make sure you have the X11 libraries, and I had just never even heard of that before, and I was like, oh, I hope I do, and it fired up eventually. And
it's really heavyweight is what it is, because it has to come with its own windowing environment. Like, well, not its own, but it needs the X11 windowing environment, and so, you know, it's big. It's not like a small... contained thing. It doesn't mean it's not sophisticated. It is. But if you don't need, you know, a tank,
you just need something little,
thing, Sumo Paint is great.
You made a great point that I mean, there's a lot of programs out there. I think Microsoft, you know, Word and Excel are great examples where they have just so much functionality that almost, you know, less than 1% of the users ever use in any regular fashion. I remember convincing people sometimes to use things like Google Docs, and they're like, well, it's not as advanced as Word. And I said, well, when was the last time you used those features? I mean, I do a mail merge, I think, once a year. And then, like, at Photoshop, there's a lot of advanced stuff you can do. I mean, you can dig into that for days, but I don't want to. I want to resize an image. I want to, you know, maybe clone stamp an area or something so I can, you know, take myself out of a picture or something. That's it. And, I mean, this looks like it's got a very familiar interface. I mean, it pops up, and I feel like I know exactly where everything is. It's got, you know, the layers down in the corner, and I like it. It, you know, I've got a really cool brush right now. I'm kind of just drawing some black lines. But, you know, it looks good. It looks really good.
Yeah, I think for most of what people need to do, this is a great service. And they're trying to stay in business by you can get a pro service level, and that allows you, it gives you a document storage area online. And it allows you to, you know, store the documents online or the images online so that you have a repository so wherever you go, you can have access to them. And also there's a lot of community features, which I haven't really gotten into. I mean, one of the a large part of their front page of their website is devoted to what are the top rated images. So it almost seems like they're integrating with kind of a social network kind of vibe where they're trying to leverage their their editor into a space that's almost like DeviantArt, right? Yeah. Where they're trying to get in to do, you're using our editor, now show everybody what you made. Right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great... I guess I didn't look at it close enough on the homepage. I just noticed that there are some really nice pictures there. But, I mean, if people made those in here, that shows it's... I mean, it's knows what it's doing. It's not a pretender at all.
Some of these look like they may be vectored. Do you know if it does vector stuff?
I don't think it does, but I could be really wrong about that. But you're right. Some of these images certainly look like vector images, not
which would be that would be cool. That would be really neat if it did that as well.
I want to throw back to something else that you said we've been talking about a little bit lately. The sites that don't require you to sign up to use a service. I think that's a trend I think that's growing, and I love it because, right. I mean, especially since Mark and I started doing the show, I mean, we're trying a lot of new web apps, you know, and every once in a while, I just want to see what you do. I don't see why some of them, you know, you're like, okay, I can see why you need me to log in so that you can help me, you know, or hold me accountable for my stuff or I can find it later. But so many of them, I'm like, why? I
just want to try it out.
I just want to try it out. And the service you're offering does not require you to identify me uniquely. Why do you do that? And then, yeah, you're giving away your personal information. I mean, I'm lucky that I use Gmail, so I don't ever get any spam, because if I didn't, I would be in a world of hurt because of all these web apps that I signed up for. Because you know the second they get in a little money trouble, they'll just start selling them out to a spam company and no problem. But.
One note. I know Mark... mentioned this earlier, but what happens if Sumo Paint crashes?
Okay, yeah.
Right? I mean, you were saying, well, you know, I mean, having local apps, that's the benefit of that, is if it crashes, then it saves the stuff. And this one, you know, I mean, since they don't have users, it's gone.
Yeah.
Like, maybe that's another service that you get if you pay, because it's already got a document storage on the back end for you. It probably gives you autosave functionality.
Yeah.
But as a guest, I'm pretty sure that it probably just loses it. That doesn't mean it's not an exceptionally great free app online. But
yeah, I mean,
it's something to keep in mind.
I would also think that maybe it's less apt to crash, unless you're doing other stuff in your browser, which maybe that's your fault then. But it's not this, you know, this full-featured program drawing in several hundred libraries from my, you know, my Windows folder to run. So I would think it'd be less chance of it doing that.
I'm not seeing their pricing for their, you know, premium. Do you know
where that's at? Don't know what the pricing is for it. Let's see. Terms and conditions. I guess you'd have to look. I mean, I...
But, you know, it does have a premium. Maybe you have to sign in and then it...
And then it offers you the business stuff. I don't know. You know, and actually, because I haven't directly verified the pricing structure or anything... Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they're doing all of this for free and giving you storage and stuff, which I would be pretty surprised about, to be honest. For me, I just assumed, you know, you know, you've got registration, you've got community stuff, you've got like saving stuff online. You know, why wouldn't you charge for that? So, but maybe I'm wrong.
But regardless, I think it's worth. I mean, it's a good app. So
yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the features at here, and if I can go through some of these with the you guys, you know, it's got layers with blending modes, which we were talking earlier today. That's all I want out of the GIMP. I would almost drop Photoshop if the GIMP did that. I would go through the pain of learning it. If it would do that, but it doesn't. It's got layer effects, shape tools, brush tool, ink tool, text tool, clone stamping, which is one of the other primary things I ever do in Photoshop, eraser tool, filters, gradients, gravity, and custom shapes. This is a great program. I'm really glad you showed it to us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Again, I think almost all of these apps... we find them because we have a problem we need to solve, right? And if we're lucky, somebody's built something to solve the problem. And if we're unlucky, then we just basically complain about it until somebody makes something great, or we make something great. Yeah.
I mean, the sad part about doing this sometimes, though, is you're like, I really want these guys to make it. I mean, I really do. I mean, there's been a couple of companies that Mark and I have looked at, and we go, God, I just really want you guys to make it. I really hope something doesn't happen. I mean, I don't know. I would pay for this. You know, it's a lot cheaper than Photoshop, but
yeah, and people I think are down on or even though as consumers we're not really used to the idea of software as a service, I really do think it is the future of software in a lot of ways. I mean, I think sometimes we're going to be downloading apps, but I think it's more likely that we'll see Google style perpetual beta apps where they're pushing features at you live all the time, so you're getting constant upgrades. There is no version 1, version right. 2, version 3. Mm-hmm. You've just got Sumo Paint. And they'll as they add new features, you just get the new feature. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think we'll see that more often. And the offline app will probably be more something like an Air app, mm-hmm. you know, or a you know, Google Web Toolkit
yeah.
Gears app.
And that so way you really don't have to, like, reinstall if you switch systems or, mm-hmm. you know, you're...
Or, I mean, we just always assume that we're going to be on the internet, but there's some times where you're not. A lot of installable software is actually sort of looking at this software as a service model. In that you don't purchase the Surface or the software, you rent it from them. Like I've heard rumors that Microsoft's been trying to implement this in Windows for a long time now, where you don't buy your copy of Windows, you basically rent it for a year. And it seems like a model that fits really well on the web, but doesn't fit really well on your home computer.
But the thing is also they need to make sure that they're integrating. It can't just be the same old software development style, and then you also pay for it yearly.
Yeah,
you have
exactly.
to have, again, the Google style. There is no, you know...
I don't have to get a new version. It comes exactly. out with it. I'm paying for this service. I get the new stuff as it happens.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Yeah, it has to be easier, better, stronger, and cheaper, really.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, it'll be cool to see if more of these move to... like a lot of things do, like the amount of bandwidth that you use, instead of saying I'm paying $12 a month for this,
right.
you can
you have it like tiered structured pricing instead of just you pay $1,000 for Adobe Photoshop. It's like how many images you make or something.
Yeah, exactly. I think a lot of people can save money. The older I get, the less I want to pirate, and especially the more things I do creatively myself, I say, well, I wouldn't want people to steal that. I mean, let's say. Somehow we could figure out a way that people had to pay for this podcast. I mean, I wouldn't want them to pirate it. I wouldn't go on a wild witch hunt to find them. But, it's people's work. It's their livelihood. And I mean, I know a couple of people or even myself that would like to, maybe create a few web apps and try and make some money off of them. And you're like, well, and I don't want them to steal it. And this also helps mitigate that because you go to the website. And if you haven't paid for it, you haven't paid for it. And you can't use it. And you can't pirate. So I don't know. I just don't want to pirate any more applications. So I love things like this because I feel guilty.
Yeah, I appreciate it when... on the flip side, I also like to be able to show developers and show creative individuals that I respect their work and I want to pay them. The way that I do it is either by telling other people about it, right? If it's not for sale, getting it out there. Mm-hmm. Or, if it is for sale, try to buy it.
Yeah, I think I wish this more companies would take this model with video games. We've seen a couple really cool Flash-based games that have come out and done this in the future, but I know with a lot of video games, I want to try it and see if I like it. I don't want to have to pay for the whole cookie if I'm not going to like it. And so like some games like Auditorium was a game that Paul showed me. It's web-based. It's like that. You get the first levels for free, and then you pay $10 for the game. It's really cheap, and it's super fun. And I would almost like to see that with every video game, because I know a lot of I won't say a lot of people I know, but I've known people in the past that pirate a lot of video games and play it for half an hour to see whether or not it's their flavor, and then either ditch it, and it's like, well, you're never going to get money out of them. And I think that's a better model for the consumer. Unfortunately, I don't think the manufacturer or developers think it's a better model, because they'd rather just have people pay for the hour that they played. But I'm not sure.
Yeah, a good example. Grand Theft Auto 4 for the computer was terrible. It ran terrible. The port was terrible. I'm sure. I actually saw it on the Xbox 360 and it was great. But the PC, if I paid $50 for that game and I took it home, and I would be really mad.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Can't take it. We can't really take it back once you've installed it and everything. So it's an example like that.
Yeah, exactly. And it used to be that you could download demos for any game. They had like a shareware demo or anything, but that doesn't exist anymore. On consoles a little bit, but definitely not on PCs. So.
Yeah, but as the software service stuff takes off, and it is. I mean, we're getting games through Steam, we're getting games through Impulse, we're getting games mm-hmm. through Greenhouse. Is that the one Penny Arcade guys did? But through all of these services, I mean, they're delivering games through these. I would not be surprised to see in the next 1 or 2 years, you pay a flat fee to Steam and you get all the games.
Yeah.
What I'm saying? Instead of doing the individual games, you just get them all. Then you can try whichever one you want, delete mm-hmm. whichever ones you want, and they give a portion of your subscription kickback to whatever games you've installed. That is something I think everybody can get behind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. There's a very similar model that the Microsoft Zune uses. And
is that for the music? Is that what?
Yeah, for the music. I don't like DRM, but I accept the DRM for the fact that I pay $15 a month, and through their service, I can download whatever I want, as much as I want, for and keep it as long as I want, as long as I keep paying my $15 a month. And I don't, that gets rid of my guilt, because they're paying the artist, they're paying the record label. I don't have to worry about it, and I can do what I want. And I do it in basically the way I did before, where I would just go online and download it and throw it on my MP3 player and go. So it's a model that's coming out, and I like it a lot. It's something that I'm really interested in. Like you were saying, if Steam did that thing where you could just pay a monthly fee and play whatever games you want, I would be ecstatic.
Yeah, then any new game that comes on Steam is just an advertisement for the platform. Yeah. You know, they get, the more stuff they get on there, the more people are going to want to subscribe to it. I mean, I don't know. I think it would be really great.
And if they wanted to, or if the publishers made them, I mean, they could easily say you can only have 5 games installed or something. And so you have to recycle.
It'd be like the O'Reilly Safari, or Netflix even kind of thing. Right. You can have five out at a time.
Yeah, you check the games out, you play them or whatever, and then you check it back in and you get something else or something.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. Yeah, because I mean, I'm not playing a million games at once.
Right.
It's usually 1 or 2 or 3. So that's a good idea.
It's a great idea.
Patent that.
All right, what do we got next?
All right, so let's move on to some topics. The first thing I want to talk about is the Google Graph API, and I'm curious to see if you guys have had any experience with the Google Graph API at all.
I have not. I'm just now seeing it. So,
I've had some. We're using it for one of the apps that we're developing over at the Center for Computational Biology, and we're just using it for data visualization. It is super, super simple.
Yeah, it's basically, the Google Graph API is a way to create graphs on the fly using the URL of the image. So let's say I want a pie chart. The image source is blah, 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 Google Graph, blah, 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 question mark type equals pie, ampersand data value equals 1 comma, and then it just takes all that.
So it's an image. It's not like a flash.
It's not flash. It's all an image. Wow. So you just embed, you just put the image and you put the source as what you want the graph to be. And so there it is.
You can probably even use JavaScript to to animate or to change these on the fly, like just change the URL, right?
I didn't even think of that at all, but you could. Yeah, I mean, you could change the image source and then use JavaScript to tell it to refresh that image.
Yeah, there's nothing stopping you from, say, batching up like 10 different URLs, caching that, and then JavaScripting between them to animate.
Yeah.
I mean, you could totally do that. I mean, that's probably taking it a little farther than it's supposed to go, well, right? Really, it's just for, give me a quick and dirty graph.
Well, maybe the data, you display the data, but it's actually the data that's updated every 30 seconds or something, so you're going to grab it and then refresh the page or something.
Yeah, there are some excellent dynamic JavaScript and Flash-based graph stuff out there.
Yeah.
And they fit a little bit of a different niche.
I see.
This one...
So this is more static-based.
It's more static because the idea is just, like, let's do the simplest possible tool to get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
And it does it, and it's fast, and it's reliable, and it's just really easy.
Yeah.
Really easy.
I mean, you don't, some of Google's API stuff, like I was messing with their Google Calendar API, and I'm pretty naive at that sort of thing, so there was a lot of sort of what would have been like curl calls, using, HTTP statuses and stuff like that, and I really, my eyes kind of glossed over that, but this is... image source equals, and then you just, if you follow the API, and it's right in the page. It's so easy to use, and they're just good, simple, clean graphs. Sweet. I don't know, and it being it's Google, it's supported everywhere. Like Paul, you were looking at, there's some Ruby plugins, some Rails plugins that you can plug in to make this even easier. So instead of like in your code putting the image source and then having Ruby, Rails put the values in, you call it just a function, and it does it for you.
Yeah, you just pass it a hash. Of the data. So you say, I've got 50% is this, 30% is that. And then it actually just does the calculation for you and says, well, you're not 100%, so I'm just going to create a new little pie section that's the rest and call it other. it really does it that easily. And it's great. And also, you don't have to specify the colors for the chart items. It'll come up with that for you. If you do specify, you only specify one color, and it comes up with all of the other
Like fades them down to the lighter colors.
Yeah, it does that.
Does it have like an API? Do you have to have like a key for it or anything like that?
No. If you went to a blog and if you took this image source that I give you, that like the, it's, if you look at the one that's on the front of their Google API front page, it's charts.apis.google.com/chart, blah, blah, blah. You know, I can give you that, and you can go to your web page, and you can insert an image, put that address in, and it'll show up.
Wow.
That's it.
What do they get? I mean, do they have monetization? What do they get?
No, it's just this is another one of those things that Google did where they said, hey, we need this tool here at Google. And so they built it, and they're like, well, we might as well let everyone else use it because it's just really that good, you know? So
it looks awesome. I mean,
yeah, it looks great. And again, it's not super flashy, but 9 times out of 10, you don't need flashy. You just need data. You just need visualization. Yeah. So we're really happy with it, working with it. We were thinking, you know, well, okay, we'll go grab a Flash library or something mm-hmm. integrated into the site and work with it and put it in the controllers and make some helpers for it and stuff. But you know, we got a tip. Hey, check out the Google chart thing. And after looking at it, it did everything that we needed. No frills, and it took the development effort required was nearly zero.
Yeah,
I mean, it was just that easy, and so that's the kind of thing you want.
Yeah,
tools that help you do what you need to do faster with a minimum of problems.
Yeah, so kudos to Google for developing that and giving us more awesome tools that makes our life easy.
I swear they have things that I've never seen. They just come out of nowhere.
Oh, there's so much stuff Google is doing. You can't keep track of them all. Yeah, it's amazing.
And I bet
what they do.
I bet that actually comes out of their 20%, right?
Yeah.
20% of the time you work on your own thing, and I hear that there's pretty heady competition in the company to one-up other people with your 20%. And I'm sure if you make a tool that everybody wants to use, that's probably some pretty big bragging rights right there.
Probably the Google Graph guy is like walking around with his chest puffed out, you know? Hey, guys.
A lot of the Google apps came from the 20%. Like, didn't Gmail and some?
Yes,
that's what I heard. Gmail was a 20% project. That is amazing right there. That some guy was like, "Well, I just want to make email easier," and now it's, I could not live without Gmail right now. My life would be
the spam terrible. Protection alone is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I've created a workflow around Gmail. You know, it's like I have. If I have not archived it, that means I need to do something with that. And that's, I mean.
Yeah, and the other thing is, it's hard to put a price tag on not having to worry, right? Yeah. I mean, when you had traditional email, you would worry about how big is this? How much space am I taking up with my mail? Mm-hmm. How do I back it up? How do I make sure that, you know, if I have to upgrade my OS with, I don't have to care about any of that.
Yeah, oh, like Pop versus IMAP. Like, Pop deletes it from the server, whereas IMAP doesn't. Like, the other day at work, some guy connected to one of our email accounts that we specifically wanted to keep everything on the email account, and he did Pop instead of IMAP, and it just downloaded and removed everything. So later, I was like, I log into that email account. I was like, oh, where are these 5,000 emails?
On his desktop.
Yeah, on his desktop. I was like, you better back that up while you have it, so... I don't know. It's
the search is amazing in Gmail too.
Oh yeah, yeah, super fast on thousands and thousands of emails.
Yeah, like, or how about
very very relevant
millions of lines of Google Talk chat. I mean the ability to search my chat, it makes me so happy because you're just like, okay, what was that? Mark and I were talking.
We always have arguments and it's settled by hey, we talked about this in Google chat like 3 days ago and we just Google it up real quick and yep, sure enough.
Yeah. Or like Mark will ask me a question. I'm like, I just said that to you like 5 minutes ago and he's like, no, you didn't. And I'll like search in Google chat, man. You'll see right there.
I feel a little bad gushing about Gmail all the time, but it literally is best of breed.
Yeah.
I've just not seen anything like it. I mean, it in some sense, you know, it's like just yeah, okay, it's the best. We're always yammering about how good it is, and you feel a little bit like bad because, but no, I think it really honestly deserves a praise.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes
it is the best thing out there.
I mean, like, people argue about everything, operating systems, development languages. I mean, all the same arguments that we've heard of, but it seems that there is really no argument. It's like, no, my email, okay, 17 gigs. Who else? No, Yahoo's unlimited. Great. Well, it's got the clunkiest interface ever. And then you're like, okay, I have Google search powering through my, you know, scouring through my email for me. Well, oh, no one else? Okay, well.
And IMAP was one of those things that a lot of they did Pop only because it's IMAP, there's a little bit more overhead. And
yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's everything used to be Pop. And then they're like, well, we'll do IMAP for you. And you're like, yeah. Oh, thank
IMAP.
You.
I think some of the other ones have followed suit now with the IMAP, but
yeah.
Yeah, the only, I think one of the hurdles for IMAP and Gmail was that Gmail doesn't use a folder structure. Everything's tagged.
Right.
Right. And so they had to come up with a way of sort of tricking IMAP into thinking the tags were folders.
Yeah.
And so And they managed to come up with it. It works. It but does. Yeah, it's a little bit tricky because you'll have one email that'll be in several different folders.
Yeah, you're like, what? That doesn't make sense. So yeah, they made their own interface. I mean, between the IMAP protocol and Gmail.
But IMAP's awesome because you can move it to a folder, quote unquote folder, and it when you go log into Gmail, it's there. So it's kind of like a sync versus pop, where it downloads it from and deletes it from the server. You know, so
yeah, I mean, honestly, how many people's home computers are backed up and more secure than the mail server in which they're using? I don't know. Yeah, when I moved to DreamHost, one of the things I was happy is that they pushed Google Apps a lot. They said, hey, well, I mean, we can host your email for you, or you can use Google Apps and use Gmail to do it for you. I mean, it's a great thing that it takes the load off other people's work and lets Google focus on that core competency of Gmail. You know, that's not their core competency, but one of their competencies of Gmail, and let the rest of us stop trying to mess with email and worry about it all the time. I mean, the fact that all my email for my websites is on, in Google's cloud, it means that if I switch hosts, I don't have to worry about it. You know, I can just keep, if I keep the DNS the same, I can log in and I'm good to go.
The only potential downside is really that they'll index it and they advertise to you. But honestly, that's a price I'm happy to pay.
Well,
advertising, I don't think is too intense.
Yeah, people complain about advertising, but the funny thing is Google wants to give you ads that you need. It's people are like, well, they're looking in your stuff, but they're looking in their stuff to give you stuff that they think that you need. And if they give you stuff that you don't want, that does them no good and it does you no good. So why would they do that? You know, I've seen some sites where you can tell that they did, business to business ads, not like a Google AdWords thing where, a business said, hey, I want you to put this ad on your website, and it doesn't fit at all. And it, when you're in the Google world, you get so used to everything being right. I mean, I remember I made a blog post once because Google sort of indexed one of my websites wrong for that first, 2 seconds or whatever that it was up, and the ad was just so off. It was almost silly. Yeah. It does no one any good.
Given enough time, though, it'll get scary close. It's wow, that's right on.
If it indexes multiple sites, like I'll Google search or something, and it'll index my... But then again, if it gives... I mean, their goal is to give you an ad for something that you want.
Right.
Not even want, but may need.
Right. No, I think people too often fall into the trap where they assume... They pigeonhole advertisers and consumers into opposing groups, like they're versus each other, right? The advertisers are against the consumers and trying to trick them into doing things. But that's not what it is. I want to know about things that I want.
Yeah,
I love to hear about things that I want to buy. Right? Mm-hmm. It's really that we have to find a way to let the advertisers who want to sell me things touch me, so that I can know that they're selling them. You know, and that's good for everybody. But if I'm getting advertised about things that I don't want, it doesn't. You're right. It doesn't help anybody.
Yeah.
But the adversarial relationship, I think, is something that people need to get over. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, getting over the fact that advertisement is evil. It's only evil if it's, either advertising things you don't want, in which case the advertiser is really making a mistake.
Yeah. Exactly. That's stupid.
Right. Or if getting in the way of, really in your face ads for television, whatever, that cover up the whole web page. Nobody likes those.
Exactly.
They should just stop that.
Note to advertisers, please stop that.
No one likes it.
You just annoy us and make us not want to purchase your product. So
another clever thing they do is they put you can put RSS feeds in your email too. And that's the precise place where they put an ad as well. Isn't it? Yeah, it is. Yeah. They'll put a one-line ad for the RSS. So it's something that you're going to be looking for, and then you'll see the ad. So it's very clever that they put that there.
Yeah. Google's done a great job of being really non-invasive about it. Their motto of don't be evil is befitting, and I think it's working because I've never really been mad at them for their advertising. It's been, every time it's always something that I'm interested in. They're not way off, they're not trying to sell me, Sex in the City DVDs or anything like that. It's, it's like computer gaming peripherals. I'll probably buy one or two of those in my lifetime. So I don't know. I think it's good.
Yeah, I think it's great. And I do think that their only problem has really been don't be evil and make money for your shareholders.
Yeah.
That can be a tough line to walk.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And so they try to do it as best they can. And I think that they've done a spectacular job on the most part. They're going to make mistakes, though, and they're going to do things that are iffy. But
I mean, the greatest mistake for me, I thought, was their purchase of Jaiku. But even then, they did a great job of handling it. They bought Jaiku, and they were gonna, you know, integrate it with the Google Apps backend or whatever. And then it turned out that they decided it wasn't gonna work. I mean, I think Twitter got too strong, so they instead released the source code as open source. And let the developers who were developing it, you know, they released them and said, hey, you can work on this. That's okay. And said, you know, fine. They're not going to just close it up and be jerks about it. They're not going to say, like, no, you can't have this, and then shut it off. They said, you know, it's not going to be profitable for us, but we're not going to, you know, screw you guys over. So go have at it and do good things. A lot of companies don't do that. And I was really happy that they did that. Like, even Jaiku.com, the domain and stuff, they gave back to the original team and said, hey, you know, you can't make money off this. Leave it open, but go for it. You can have it. They didn't shut it down. So big props to Google.
All right. Are we ready for the next topic?
All right. So the next topic that we want to talk about is an article I found called 20 PHP Libraries That You Need to Know. So there's quite an extensive list. The funny part about it is the first four ones are all chart making APIs. So, and not one of them looks like it actually uses the Google Chart API. So if you want to make more advanced charts or perhaps more customized charts, these would be good options for you. Some RSS parsing libraries. I know, Mark, I've used
both of those, actually.
Which one do you like better?
I want to say SimplePy just because it was the last one that I used, and it was super easy to use.
Yeah,
I think they're both great, though.
Yeah, I mean, I love libraries. Like, I mean, one of the things we talk about with sort of these MVC frameworks is that they have a lot of little things like this built in, and it makes your job as a developer so much easier. Like SimplePy, I don't want to parse through all these XML files. Right. I really just want to give something an address and have it return back an array of all the RSS stuff. That's all I want.
I think SimplePy was like four lines of code to set it all up with the cache and everything.
Yeah, that's, you know, so, or like the next one, a PHP thumbnail generator. Like, I don't want to mess with image magic and stuff. It's a nice little simple function that I can just give it an image and it spits back a thumbnail. That's great.
Wow, this looks cool. The PHP payment library with the author.
It does look cool. Yeah.
I know, I there's Google Checkout and stuff, and I knew that PayPal had one. They have an API that you have to either do it all yourself or you have to use something like this is already built for you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that's cool that they have that.
Yeah, or the next one, the PHP OpenID project, which we've been talking a lot about OpenID lately, and it's,
so you can integrate that just like instantly, pretty much.
Yeah, exactly.
Library,
and the next ones are a bunch of database abstraction things. And the funny part about this is because we've all done development in PHP, and we all have our own DB class, and I'd almost be willing to bet that they're all named DB dot, you know, PHP or DB dot class of PHP because we've all done the same thing. And so this is kind of a way. Some of them, I was looking at them, and they let you kind of do the pair DB format, which some people like, some people don't. But maybe if that's your thing and you don't want to use pair, because I hate pair. I don't know about you guys, but I think pair is ridiculous.
I haven't used much pair. Like, I know what it is, but I haven't had to use it.
It's basically like CPAN or GEMS, but it's like it got hit with an ugly stick, and it does not work half the time.
You get into dependency hell with it pretty quick.
Yeah, it's terrible. So it's not there's not a standard way of the PHP program to sort of access these downloaded pair libraries. Mm-hmm. So sometimes projects, Laconica is one. It's a microblogging platform we were playing with, and it used pair libraries. And I think it actually sort of froze the pair libraries into the program, but they don't explicitly tell you that. So I spent like a day trying to install different pair one modules, and you want to talk about you get in trouble with gems. Talk about pair when it requires an older version of a pair library. Oh god, that was terrible. So I don't know.
This PDF generator looks cool.
Yeah, I mean,
I've only done PDF generation with the Zend framework, so I don't know what it would be like to even try to do it by hand. But if I did, I'd probably want to look for a library like this.
Yeah. I'm not sure what this one does, but all I want out of a PDF generation library is I almost want to be able to spit my XHTML out to it and have it basically print it like I printed it from my printer onto the Adobe PDF.
That was a solution we ultimately landed at is just that templating your own PHP or sorry, templating your own PDFs turns out to be kind of, you only have to do it once, but it is not fun.
No, it's not
fun.
I don't know. When I did, it was a grid system, basically.
Yeah, basically. Well, yeah. There's a bunch of different strategies to it, okay. But like, yeah. But it's just it's laborious. It's slow. It's
very
it,
slow.
It makes, you know, doing stuff with CSS seem like amazing. But so what we ended up using is there's just a binary you can get called HTML2PDF. And then takes an HTML file and turns it into a PDF as if you printed it. Mm. So that means you're pulling out of the web framework for a minute, going to binary, you know, running an app thing and then pulling back a PDF. Mm. So it's not ideal, but it turned out to be a lot easier than writing a bunch of templates, just saying, I'm just going to take this HTML and just dump it. But this right. kind of thing, too, is good because you don't always want to right. have to descend to the to that level. So
yeah, and you don't want to have to install the whole Zen framework just for a PDF because it comes with a whole lot more. So this is cool.
Yeah. So I don't know. There's also libraries look at, you know, Excel stuff to work with Mailer or to work with email. But at the end, Paul, I wanted to show you, there's a couple of them for doing test units, which you do a lot of test-driven development now, and you really like it a lot. So I mean, why don't you explain to us a little bit what test-driven development is and why we should use it?
Test-driven development is a programming methodology where instead of just writing code and then viewing, you know, going to the web page and refreshing it over and over and putting in a bunch of test data or whatever and seeing if it works, it's a whole different way of approaching development. And what you do is you use some sort of testing framework. In Rails, I use RSpec, but mm-hmm. the one built in is called TestUnit. And first, what you do is when you're starting out writing some code, you first identify a problem, like the user has to log in or something like that, right? And you write a test for that, which fails. If it doesn't fail, then that means your test sucks because you haven't written anything yet, right? Yeah. So you write the test fails, you then go in and write the code until the test passes. That's test-driven development. Mm-hmm. You start with the test, then you write the code. You get benefits from this. One benefit is all your code is tested. You don't have to go to the web page and refresh mm-hmm. it over and over and see things. All that stuff is done in the test layer, and you don't have to do it. You just run the test suite. The second thing this gives you is it gives you a rich, very detailed specification list. It shows you everything your app does. So RSpec especially can spit out a document that just turns all of your tests into basically a bulleted list that says users have an email that looks like this. They can have a password that's this size. They can have this that does this. You know, it's just mm-hmm. very rigorous, kind of boring to read, really. But at least if you go from developer to developer and you're coming in on a new app, mm-hmm. you can immediately see what the app does. You can see what all the code does, and you can see what all the tests do. So testing is great. It's mm-hmm. great because doing functional testing in the browser manually is no fun.
Right. You have to yeah. put the data in by hand. You got to try to log in. You got to
yeah.
mess up your password just to see what it's going to output. Is it going to yeah, say,
exactly.
you know?
Exactly. Whereas if you're doing it at test-driven development, you go through and you say, oh, okay, if the password is input and it's wrong, then it should do this. Mm-hmm. And you run the test, and it fails. And then you're like, oh, okay, well, then you do some code, and then yeah.
So how do these testing frameworks access your application to test them? I mean, I guess it seems to me like I can say I can write, like, okay, I want to test to see if my login fails. But, I mean, does then the testing framework actually, you know, access the page with curl and then input the data and then submit the form? And, I mean,
well, on the Rails side of things, everything's broken up into an MVC mm-hmm. organizational structure, right? So your tests are broken up as well. You have unit tests, which access only the models. They never touch web pages. Okay. It only says that
this function is going to work this way.
Right.
Which users is, you know, really easy to test.
And, right. Okay. That stuff is, and then you have the second layer. Typically, testing is broken up into, you have unit tests, integration or functional tests, and then integration tests. I might have that backwards because I always break it up in an MVC way instead of breaking it up. But the traditional way of talking about it is unit tests, functional tests, and integration testing. And integration testing is a full stack. It's when you're mm-hmm. like looking at the user interface all the way down.
Okay.
But in RSpec, in the Rails side of things, what you'd do is you'd create the model tests, right? The unit tests, which just test to make sure the data layer is solid,
right? Like the individual functions and things.
And you have to they give you a fairly rich set of methods for stubbing. Like you don't necessarily want to talk to the authorized.net credit card processing server.
Okay, yeah.
So you stub it and you say, assuming it returns this response, my code has to do this. Assuming it returns this response, my code should do this.
Okay.
And so you stub it so that you're not actually pinging that server.
Right.
Mm. And then once you move from that, then you move to the controller. And you're saying that if that's where you do something like, if the user fails to log in, it should redirect them to here. And there should be a flash message, like, or some sort of message div. That's well, not div. You're not getting to that, but there should be some sort of thing. Like, it should throw a 300, or it should show, you know, throw a, you know, HTTP 200 or whatever. So that's where you do your controller testing stuff, and then you move into the view stuff. And the view testing is saying there should be a div on there. It should have a class that looks like this. It should, oh. And you know, honestly, like, I treat the view testing with a lot less rigor. Because it's very
it's more transparent.
Once you're once you're that far out away from the model,
if
layer,
the controller works, then it should
it needs to work, right? If the controller tests are good and solid, and if the model tests are good and solid, unless you have a really distributed team, like if your team is really distributed, and so you have like I need to hand the person who's writing the views, the HTML, a set of tests that have to pass, right? So. They will go, well, what do I need to name this content div? Well, there's a test for it. There needs to be a content div. So all the CSS matches the views, and you have a whole bunch of people working on the project. Yeah. If your specs are good, if your tests are good, all of that all comes together.
Yeah, or I mean, just even so much as saying, like, there needs to be a test that there is a text field named this. Because, I mean, people have different naming conventions and stuff, and that can be a pain in the butt. But, I mean, you're ahead of time, you're saying, you look at your test and you say, okay, well, my controller is expecting a div or, you know, a title of information named this and a password information named this. So if you don't pass those tests, then ours will not work together. Yeah.
No, that's an excellent example. Like if in my controller tests, I know that my form action is going to be accepting a variable called, you know, Bob, then I know there must be on the originating HTML page, there has to be a form that has a target of the target, and inside there has to be at least one input element that has a variable name of Bob. Mm-hmm. Like, that has to be there. I don't care what it looks like. I don't care where it is. It's got to be there. Now, this starts to get a lot more iffy once you get into JavaScript
language. Yeah.
Because with Ajax and with JavaScript, you can be dynamically changing the form from hell to breakfast once you are, you know, on your own. And so that's again another reason why the view tests I tend not to hit as hard.
I mean those tend to be more, you'll notice things wrong with
them. It's just more
visually
wishy-washy, and there's so many things that could still work that the test might fail on. Right? Like I might make rigorous tests, but that it doesn't necessarily mean that the site
is what's bad. The structure of these things written? How would you go about writing a test like this? Is it just
The model tests, the most basic test would be like, say, and the actual syntax of RSpec is the method name that you use for your test is it, and then you have a string, so it quote should, well, say describe user, it should have an email address, do, then you have a block, and I say u equals user.new u dot should space respond to email. That means it has to have a method called email.
Yeah, the user, the class U has to have a method email.
So you give it certain pieces of data to throw into the function, and you say it should return this or else fail.
Right, basically. And you don't say have to say else fail because it'll fail on its own.
Okay.
So you should say it should return this. And then what it'll do is it runs the test, and if it said I was expecting this, I got this, fail.
Interesting.
And it fails out. And so the tests are very expressive, like they're very natural language sounding. These ones in here, they might be fine too. I mean, I've never used Simple Test or PHP Unit, these two testing frameworks for PHP. I didn't even know there were testing frameworks.
Yeah,
for PHP.
Me either. I thought it would have to be something highly integrated into an MVC to do. Just from hearing you talk about it before, I wouldn't assume that you could just do it yourself. But
yeah, you can. And so the way that I would see that these PHP ones probably would work is you would have a test directory. Mm-hmm. When you're testing one of your PHP files, let's say, right, you'd say include X, right? And somehow it would trap it. And then you'd say, there must be a method for this, there must be a method for this, there must be a method for this. You know, so there must be a function written that does this, expects this, and returns this.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
So that's how I'm assuming it works.
Yeah.
First time I ever saw this unit testing, I think it was CPAN with Perl. Whenever you download like a Perl module, it does a test before it actually will install in your system.
Wow,
to make
really?
Sure it works. Well, often, I think it installs and then does the test, and then if it fails, it'll tell you.
Oftentimes the testing takes longer than the downloading.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it'll test every little function in the Perl program that your module that you're downloading. So
and that's actually one of the reasons why Rails development is so fast. Is why, like, I mean, they've gone from Rails 2.1 which was last summer, to 2.2 to 2.3, which just came out. I mean, and each one of those has had a huge number of features put into it. Mm-hmm. And the development team is not that big. Like, the core development team is very small. Mm-hmm. The reason they're able to do it so rapidly is because the whole Rails system is heavily tested, and they're accepting patches from everybody everywhere on GitHub. So somebody will submit some code. They will not accept it if it's not tested. But if it is tested, they put it in, they run all their tests, it doesn't break, boom, you're good.
Hello. Yeah, I could see this being great for, oh, I want to make a little patch and fix this and whatever, and then, oh, but yeah, but if you didn't pass the test, you know.
Well, it's and it'll go back and test all your old stuff, too. I mean, if you run the whole gamut of tests, I mean,
you know your code.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you might be fixing one feature on one complete opposite side of your application and think, there's no way that that'll break anything else. And inevitably it does, but your test suite will get that for you before you put it up and let other people play with it. And then they find it themselves.
This makes other people's patches cheaper.
Yeah.
You know, to test.
Like, you need less trust.
Right.
Right. Yeah, you don't have to necessarily have met them and known them and looked at their other code. All it has to do is not break your tests, pass their tests. You then do a code review of their tests.
To make sure.
You don't really care what their code looks like. It might be the sloppiest code ever. Yeah. It doesn't matter. That can come later.
As long as the tests are sound.
If the tests are cool,
it won't break things.
That's cool. I like that. This is the first time I've been really exposed to this, and I think this is really cool.
It sounds really awesome. It is really cool. I've never done it. But.
The workflow with Rails especially, there's a tool that comes along with it called Autotest. So what I do is I'll have like three terminal windows open, right? One of them is running my little Rails server. One of them is running Autotest. And one of them is just like a console that I can use for doing whatever. So while I'm coding, Autotest is basically running a loop of all the tests all the time. And it's only watching files that change. So as soon as I save a file, it runs a test on the file. And it goes, boom, red lines out or green lines out or whatever.
Something up.
And I know immediately. And then it does a very clever thing where, like, if I'm working in file A, it only runs a test on A. And the clever thing is if that test used to fail... If there was a failing test before, which all of a sudden now passes, it then runs all the tests on the entire site.
It's almost like an incremental testing.
It's an incremental testing, right? So it only stays local until you've done something important, and then it runs all the other ones.
Okay.
So it's pretty neat. It is very processor intensive.
Yeah.
That's one thing I've noticed. Like on the last generation black MacBook, for example, the fan would kick in, it would start blowing, it was not cheap.
So there's obvious benefits to the unit testing. Do you think it's is it a lot of work to write these things, or do you actually think it saves time because you find errors faster?
It's a little of both. It does take time, but like learning anything takes time. Mm-hmm. But the one thing that you'll really find that helps you is it changes the way you code. It changes you from thinking about I need to make this feature work to first, I need to describe the feature in the form of a test.
Which is way better.
Then I need to write it. Because once you turn that and flip it around, it makes your code better. And it makes you think about problems in a different way. And also, if you're doing a multi-person team, if you're not just by yourself, code management is much, much easier when you can get to a new project, run the tests, look at the tests, and you basically have a functional idea of how the program runs.
Yeah, so. I was thinking about this in business terms of scope creep when if you're doing some contracting work for another company, you go through and you say, you basically say, this is the functionality, these are the tests that are going to pass, and if they try and bring up something that you might have to run another test for, that's scope creep. That was not included in the original, you can even have them sign off on the test. You say, these are the tests I'm going to perform on my test-driven development, and anything else is added is going to be added scope creep, and then that doesn't happen because that's a big problem where it's like, why don't we just add this little feature? And you think that's not a big thing, but after 10 of them happen, you're like, well, I've wasted 3 days on that.
Yeah, no, that's important, and actually, that's what sort of separates RSpec from Test Unit. Test Unit comes with Rails; it's the built-in testing framework. But it's not as expressive. Like, I mean, when you're just reading it or if you dump it to a document, it's not as easy to just read along. Like, I wouldn't want to hand it to a business person and say, well, here's the test we're running. But RSpec is. It's very readable. And so when you do dump it out and you hand it to somebody, they can read it.
Yeah, I mean,
as long as the developer is being a little bit rigorous about not using tricky words.
You were explaining the syntax, I mean, it sounds like, especially when it's in Ruby, which is almost a language that you can almost speak vocally, it sounds very natural and looks, I'm assuming it would look a lot more natural too. Like you can quickly scan it and see where things are and what the tests that are being performed.
Yeah, the next step above RSpec too is there's another layer of testing called the tool that they're using is called Cucumber, but that is for it's really feature driven development where you have or behavior driven development is like and there's a specialized syntax for it like. You know, as a user, when I do this, I expect that. And it allows you to naturally tests the whole stack. It doesn't do unit testing or anything like that. It runs the whole thing and you give it these specialized frameworks. I haven't gotten into doing Cucumber testing myself, but it's the next step for us in our test-driven development environment is doing Cucumber testing after we get really comfortable with our test-driven development as it stands now.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the current trend in programming is these large frameworks of very helpful development, you know, tools, plus, you know, also altering the way we've developed. Because in the past, I don't know, my experience has always been that I thought revision control was revolutionary, you know, and I mean, that's, you kind of see the light. That's almost the start of it where you're doing this sort of, okay, well, I FTP it down to my box and right. I do it. And then I FTP it back up to the web server and I refresh on the page and see what happened.
I don't break anything.
Yeah. And then, you know, your coworker FTPs their changes that they downloaded 5 minutes ago and overwrite your changes. And then, you know, to now, I mean, that was like sort of the first step into this world that I'm getting into of seeing that there are structured ways of developing where, I mean, it's not just solo development anymore. You know, you've got friends that you have to play with and in, you know, the business world, if you lose code, that's money, you know, that's time and wasted and possibly innovation that is wasted. So,
and we at our group probably spend more time thinking about code maintenance than other places do, because that's a big deal for us. I mean, we have students that come in and they're going to work on things, or we have another developer that might come in and work on things. Having the code be able to be readable and manageable by not just one person is a really big deal. And so maybe we spend more time thinking about that and talking about it than other groups do. But I think that the code that comes out of that kind of philosophy ends up being better code in general anyway.
Well, and there's just so much more documentation to it. I mean, instead of saying, here, write a wiki article all day about it, I mean, it's part of your development structure is documentation. Test-driven development by nature says it gives you what your application is supposed to do. I mean, it's almost the notes of that first meeting with your client where you say, this is the functionality I want, the features I want. And as a new developer coming in, you can say, oh, well, here are the tests. This is what it's supposed to do, and this is how it works.
Yeah, as far as, like, I've sort of gotten a really cursory overview of test-driven development, but the talk that was given by the Peep Code guy, he just, you know, Rails and stuff podcast, the Peep Code podcast are excellent, and his podcast on why test-driven development changed the way that he programs and that it's a really big deal to him. It's a great podcast. I would recommend it to anybody. And as one sort of, I don't know if you guys want to continue to talk about this, but as my final point on some of the other stuff is there are two other tools that fit in to the test-driven development framework that I'd say. One of them is RCov, which allows you, it runs your tests and it examines your code and it tells you how much of your code is covered by tests. So it says, this code is not being tested. Like, basically, I ran all the tests, and none of the tests touched this function.
Like, okay.
So yeah. RCov is a great tool to find out how good coverage your tests are. And then the other one to find the quality of your tests is Heckle. And what Heckle does is it goes in, and it messes with your tests. And if your test still passes after it messed with it, it's not a very
That's
good
a bad test.
Test.
Oh, man.
It's not rigorous enough. So it goes in and shuffles things around. It might change an and to an or. It might, like, you know, it just screws with the tests and sees if they still pass.
Wow.
And so testing your test quality and testing your test coverage along with your test gives you a very, you can rely on it. You can feel like this source code is tight.
I could see this being great for security, too. Like security, cross-site scripting or like anything like that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, even the fact that... You're blowing my mind here, Paul, because all I knew about was I knew a little bit about test-driven development, and now you're telling me there's things that test your tests from your test-driven development. My head's exploding right now.
This is awesome. As if people are interested in getting into this kind of thing, a great way to do it is you know, go on GitHub or go to I'm still in the land of Rails and stuff and Ruby, and you can find an app out there, right, that people are working on. And, you know, grab it, run RCov on it, right? And see if there are any tests that are missing. Get some practice writing some tests by helping an open source project out there that needs some more
tests.
There
you go.
Write some tests. You know, see if they fail it fast or pass or fail, and then, you know, commit it and, you know, submit a patch and see what they think. And it gets you started, and you can get started with the whole community and getting writing some code without doing anything too heavy duty or heavyweight. And you already have tests there to work with to look at as an example.
I mean, not just starting your own from scratch and maybe thinking this is a daunting task. You can go look at what's out there and play around with it. And then in doing so, helping out an open source project, I think that's a great point.
Yeah. So. The other way to get into it would be... at least, again, on the Rails side of things, if you started up a new Rails project and then you install the RSpec Rails plugin, because, I like RSpec, you can then create, like, one of the actions you do in Rails is to create a scaffold. And what that does is it automatically creates the database stuff, and all of the create, update, delete, retrieve methods for everything. So, like, you create, like, a CD and whatever. It builds all that stuff for you. But if you do it as a... So instead of script generate scaffold compact disk, you script generate RSpec scaffold compact disk. It gives you all the tests. It basically writes all the tests for you. And so you get to look at the tests that would have been written for the controller, for the model, for all that stuff. They're not going to be very sophisticated. Like the tests are basically, they're not stubs necessarily, but it says this test that you're going to be able to create a new object, delete an object, that one will be added to the database correctly, that if you go to this URL, it should retrieve something and it shouldn't give you a 404. If you go to this one, it shouldn't give you a 4. You know, so but you can go and look down and I'm going, oh, okay, I see what these things look like.
Yeah.
Man,
it seems like Ruby, and especially with Rails, is the language of not reinventing the wheel.
No, that's exactly what it is. Dry is the number one thing they keep saying, which is, you know, don't repeat yourself.
Yeah.
Dry, right? That's one of the number one reasons Rails was invented. Was people were tired of reinventing the wheel every time.
Yeah. Right? That's really cool. All right. Well, I guess we better wrap it up. That's it's getting up there. There's a lot of stuff we didn't get to talk about. So, Paul, we're going to have to try and have you back sometime because you're just a wealth of knowledge. So I want to thank you, Paul. You can follow Paul on Twitter at twitter.com/_POL. I would suggest it. He's a great guy. So and we also remind you that you can subscribe to our show at faceoffshow.com/feed. And if you have a suggestion or a comment, you can email it to us. We always would like to, get an audio comment someday or a question or something and see if we can answer people's stuff. So email it to studio@faceoffshow.com. You can always Twitter us with @faceoffshow and comment on our blog. Let us know. We're always trying to improve everything we do. So any comments or suggestions are always helpful. So thank you again, Paul. We really appreciate it. And we'll see you guys again next week.